So, before I begin, I would like to express my deep appreciation to the organizers of this unique conference for their help in getting us here to Poland today. As a scholar of Zoroastrianism, I'm often faced with a somewhat unenviable task of having to present a marginally coherent picture of a little-known 3,500-year-old religious tradition that was once the personal religion of the rulers of the world's largest empire, spanning from the Oxus to the Nile. And yet today, it is reduced to around 100,000 adherents in Iran, India, and the global diasporas. The other major challenge we specialists face in better communicating our scholarly findings on Zoroastrianism is that despite a 4-millennia-long tradition, the early Iranian world of Zoroastrianism did not produce systematic philosophical treatises like its Indian and Greek counterparts, nor do we have a well-understood hermeneutical tradition like we see in the Abrahamic traditions. Perhaps a further peculiarity is the fact that virtually all the scholarship on classical Zoroastrianism has been produced by us philologists, who have read the pre-Islamic corpora in a tragically reductionist manner, with less sensitivity to philosophical issues and discourse than most of you would appreciate. This conundrum in our sociology of knowledge is worth mentioning into our audience today, simply because I am unable to showcase quote-unquote emic philosophical discourse in a manner that those of you who work on ancient philosophy of religion would find evocative. No less a savant than Voltaire echoed these sentiments when he stated, "One cannot read two pages of this abominable confusion attributed to Zoroaster without feeling sorry for human nature. Nostradamus and a urologist are reasonable people compared to this madman." What I would like to do today, therefore, is to provide you with a brief sketch of how the Zoroastrian theologians grappled with some of the salient philosophical issues associated with the radical dualism that was embedded in all social and personal praxis in ancient and late antique Zoroastrianism. In particular, I will focus on the late antique corpus in Zoroastrian Middle Persian or Pahlavi, the parent, so to speak, of classical Persian, precisely because it is there that we find literature based on a question and answer rhetorical style, reflecting an inherited oral heritage and based on sophisticated forms of citation, allusion, and intertextuality, rather than hymns of praise to various deities in ritualized contexts, as we see much earlier. Basically, the literary forms and quasi-philosophical arguments reflect the sociological realities of a largely oral world of religiosity as it was being formalized into writing in Middle Persian literature, a corpus which itself straddles the Arab Islamic conquests of Iran in the 7th century CE that fully ushered in the age of the book. It is also important to mention that virtually all the knowledge and textual production of pre-modern Zoroastrians appears to be from the exclusively male hereditary priesthood, who understood the concept of religion, or deen in Middle Persian, the likely precursor to the Arabic and Persian words for religion, deen, as an objective fact or found object, and they sought to reconcile divergent beliefs utilizing forms of rationality that were themselves tradition constituted, but unfortunately, these often still remain quite alien to our modern literary and philosophical sensibilities. My presentation today will therefore primarily serve as a historical survey of Zoroastrian knowledge production on existential questions, and in particular, it represents a discursive shift from earlier attempts to constrain religious questions and theological issues through a set of determinist and essentialist arguments about quote-unquote orthodox or mainstream Zoroastrianism. Instead, I would argue that Zoroastrian philosophical discourses ought to be understood as manifestations of complex and diverse historical processes of socialization and interpretation. In essence, Zoroastrians speaking about, from, and within the Zoroastrian tradition represent multiple hermeneutic communities through time and space. This de-essentializing approach, however, makes any attempt at describing Zoroastrianism as a trans-historical tradition especially challenging, since it is hard to argue for a unified system of beliefs, doctrines, and practices spanning 3,500 years, ranging over very varied socio-geographical topographies. Perhaps most crucially, we must intellectually grapple with the immense antiquity of the Zoroastrian tradition, where the sensus literalis for our earliest textual sources from the 2nd millennium BCE, the 5 gathas or poems ascribed to the prophet Zarathustra, Zoroaster for the Greeks, have proven impossible to philologically establish through shared scholarly consensus. A postmodern hermeneutical morass, if there ever was one, with eight major philological translations in the 20th century that barely seem to be translating the same original text. It's a very unusual problem, I mean, in the extreme scale of it. It might also interest you to know that the English language terms dualism and dualistic were first used by Thomas Hyde, professor of Hebrew at Oxford University, at the turn of the 18th century to describe Zoroastrianism in his History of the Religion of the Ancient Persians and Their Magi. The term dualist, however, became far more widely known in Europe when Pierre Bayle subsequently inserted it into his article entitled Zoroaster in his second edition of his famous dictionary. Dualism within this scholarly genealogy is thus an early modern etic term characterizing religious and philosophical concepts or frameworks, while the broader phenomenon of dualism itself has, of course, been prominent since the earliest stages of human culture and was widely known in late antiquity through Manichaeism and various Gnostic groups. The dualism we see in pre-Islamic Zoroastrianism broadly traverses a whole range of cultural and conceptual categories to be found in the cosmological, temporal, spatial, ethical, anthropological, psychological, and ontological spheres. The earliest Zoroastrian texts in Old Avestan, however, clearly encode both a cosmogonic and a cosmic dualism, in the sense that cosmogonic dualism refers to or indexes a myth or myths that suggest that the contents of the world were arranged and subsequently disarranged by two primordial entities, Ahura Mazda, or God in our parlance, and Angra Mainyu, or the foul spirit in theirs. We also have a cosmic dualism, which refers to the division of the world into two, much like we see with Plato, the menoi, or world of thought, or the mental realm, and the world of living beings, or material realm, or geti, in Middle Persian. Ahura Mazda, or Ormazd, as he is called in Middle Persian, hence the Straits of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf, is the supreme deity in Zoroastrianism, responsible for all that is good in the world. He is described in our late antique and early Islamic sources as the greatest knowledgeable one, who nurtures and protects, who is beneficent and pure, whose deeds are good, who forgives, whose judgments are good, who has all powers, and whose worship is great and enduring. The chief adversary of Ormazd in Zoroastrianism is Angra Mainyu in Avestan, or Ahriman, as he was called in the Middle Persian texts, the foul spirit. The onomastics of foul here have an olfactory sense of fetid or stinking. Our texts narrate that prior to the creation of our world, Ahriman was in a metaphysical state, in darkness, in the depths, with retrograde knowledge and a desire to kill. In the Zoroastrian worldview, it is Ahriman who is ultimately responsible for bringing evil and all its negative consequences into the world, injustice, suffering, aging, decay, and finally death. In this tradition, the life cycle is thus not God-given at all, but an evil parasitic addition that compromises the perfect world that God first created for his creations. The revulsion for Ahriman was so powerful that Zoroastrian scribes expressed their scorn by writing his name upside down in our extant manuscripts and codices. Ahriman is visually depicted here in the investiture relief of Ardashir I, the founder of the Sasanian Empire, as being trampled underfoot by Ormazd's horse as the divine ruler bestows the ring of power upon his earthly counterpart, the Sasanian king, who is himself trampling the last Parthian king from the former dynasty. The dualistic visual idiom of this relief beautifully encodes the religious underpinnings of late antique Iranian imperial politics. Let me now turn to the Middle Persian literature, where we find a number of cataphatic statements that attribute to Ormazd all good things supereminently, where God is understood to be goodness itself. So for example, we find it stated, every good thing was created by Ormazd, and every bad thing was created by Ahriman. And we also find it stated, everything can be changed except the substance of good and evil. It is impossible by any means to change the substance of good to evil and the substance of evil to good. Ormazd, because of his good substance, has not approved any evil and falsity. Ahriman, because of his evil substance, has not accepted any goodness and truth. Such sentiments in our late antique sources echo those already found in the archaic Old Avestan corpus of the mid-second millennium BCE, the five gathas or poems of Zarathustra, where we first find it stated. Thus, those two spirits or mentalities, mind you, in the beginning, renowned as the twin sleeps, the twin thoughts and speeches, their two actions, a good and a bad. Between those two, those who give good gifts have discriminated rightly, not those who give bad gifts. Whenever the two spirits or mentalities come together, one determines for the first time that there will be life for the good and lack of survival for the bad, and also how their existence shall be at the last. The worst existence will be that of the wicked, but for the sustainer of truth or order, Asha, there will be best thought. The lived realities of our mixed world are direct products of a metaphysical dualism between these two minute spirits or mentalities, cognate with the English words for mind and mental. As part of the dualist worldview that exculpates God from all forms of evil and suffering, Ormazd, prior to the creation of the world, Dam Dahishni, offers the foul spirit a peaceful compromise. This, despite his omniscience that his generous offer will undoubtedly be rebuffed by his evil antagonist. Then Ormazd, although he knew how the creation would be in the end, offered the foul spirit peace, saying, "Bring my creation aid and praise it. As reward, you will not die or grow old. You will not deteriorate or be impaired." The meaning is that if he, Ahriman, was not to provoke the battle, then he would not himself become undone, and profit would accrue to both spirits from it. The foul spirit howled, "I shall not bring your creation aid, I shall not praise it. Rather, I shall destroy you and your creation forever and ever. I shall incite all your creations to unfriendliness to you, but friendliness to me." And the explanation for it is this: he thought that Ormazd could do nothing against him, therefore he was offering peace. So he refused and even threatened. Much like any decision theory in a negotiation, Ahriman's wholly paranoid and retrogressive nature conditions him to view kindness as weakness, a cognitive bias which Ormazd, given his omniscience, recognizes but does not actively exploit. The Zoroastrian theologians specifically argue that it was not Ormazd's desire to be preemptive because it was simply not ethical to assume that the foul spirit would refuse, despite knowing that he would in the end. To go to a preemptive battle against the lie, this is the cosmic lie, that Ahriman himself created all the good things, when that other one is not fighting against the lights, to smite him when he has not smitten the lights, to demand expiation before the damage, to demand revenge before an act of vengefulness has taken place, this he did not consider to be right and lawful. The Zoroastrian sources are very clear to argue that the character of the two antagonists were fundamentally opposed in nature prior to the sequence of cosmogonic acts performed by Ormazd that produced our world, which then became one of mixture, or gumezition, between good and evil, hence our typology of radical dualism. The Middle Persian encyclopedia known as the Bundahishan tells us the metaphysical origin story of the material world as follows. Ormazd was in the highest place in omniscience and goodness for an unlimited time in the light. That light is the throne and place of Ormazd. Some say the endless lights. That omniscience and goodness was there for an unbounded time. That is, there were Ormazd, his goodness, the religion, and the time of Ormazd. Ahriman was in darkness, in the depths, with backward knowledge and desire to kill. His desire to kill is his nature, and that darkness his place. Some say endless darkness. Between them, there was the emptiness. And at the border, they are both bounded, for between them is emptiness, so they are not connected with one another. This commonly cited passage reiterates the radical character of Zoroastrian dualism, where the two metaphysical sources of good and evil are both distinct and uncreated, and more importantly, not contiguous spatially with endless light up above and endless darkness below, and a vacuum of sorts between them. The first writer to present a Greek readership with a clear statement of the fundamental opposition between Ormazd and Ahriman, as we see here, may have been Eudoxus of Cnidus, a famous mathematician and geographer who was a contemporary and friend of Plato's. According to Diogenes Laertius, Aristotle in his lost treatise on philosophy reported that, according to the Magoi, there were two essential principles, a good and an evil divinity, one named Zeus or Oromazdes, the other Hades or Aremanios, And we are told that Eudoxus had said much of the same much far earlier in his Circuit of the Earth. Though, of course, we are unsure of whether Eudoxus provided the Persian names with their Greek equivalents, since none of his works are now extant. We also find a later Western account of this Persian myth as reported by Plutarch in the 1st and 2nd century CE, where the two creators, or demiurgoi, are said to be rival craftsmen, or antitechnoi. This is the opinion of the majority of the wisest of men. Some believe that there are two creators, rival craftsmen as it were, the one the creator of good things, the other of evil things. Others call the better divinity God and the other daemon, as does Zoroaster the Magus, who they say lived 5,000 years before the Trojan War. Zoroaster called the former Horomazes and the latter Arimanius. Furthermore, he showed that one was more like light than anything else apprehended by the senses, and the other more like darkness and ignorance. The Zoroastrian theologians tell us that Ormazd actually produced the world through his innate wisdom, or Asen Chred, and that ultimately, at the end of time, he will take back his creation to himself through religion or deen. Concomitantly, in the late antique Middle Persian literature, the Zoroastrian theologians tended to deny the foul spirit his future existence, as in the Bundahishan, where we find it stated that Ormazd is he who was, is, and shall be, while Ahriman is said to be he who was, is, but shall not be. Other sources claim that Ahriman has no physical existence at all, as in the Dinkard, where it is said that Ahriman never existed and does not exist, and that the gods exist while the demons do not. In this dualistic worldview, it is incumbent upon humans to avoid evil and to foster the good by recognizing the parasitic nature of Ahriman and his demons in terms of their ability to corrupt our epistemologies, and so we find it stated. One must know how Ahriman and the demons deceive and lead astray, how they are mixed into every part of the good creatures, how they hide the straight and true road and way, how they crookedly exhibit what is as what is not, how they act as highwaymen in the minds, thoughts, words, and deeds of beings in the material world, and how they untiringly comply with the commitment of crimes. Rather than simply contend with an ethical dualism as we see in most other traditions, Zoroastrian social actors had to uniquely contend with the profound social, psychological, and epistemological consequences of a thoroughgoing dualism that cleaved all social and personal life practices into good and evil, pure and impure, and right and wrong. The existential challenge of such a powerful dualistic cleavage of the world is perhaps best seen in a text called From the Book of Advice of Zarathustra, or Selections from the Teachers of Old. The teachers of old, who have the foremost knowledge of the religion, have said that at the age of 15, one should know the following: who am I and whom do I belong? Where did I come from and to where will I go back? And of what lineage and family am I? And what are my duties in the world of the living, and what is my reward in the world of thought? And did I come from heaven, or have I always been on earth? Do I belong to Ormazd, or do I belong to Ahriman? To the gods or to the demons, to the good or the bad? Am I a human or a demon? How many are the paths, and which is my religion? What is good for me, and what is bad? Who is my friend, and who is my enemy? Are the origins one or two? From whom is goodness and badness? From whom is light and darkness? From whom is fragrance and stench? From whom is right and wrong? From whom is forgiveness and mercilessness? I think you get the point about the dualism. The text proceeds to give us the answers to these existential questions. Now, he who can explain the meanings has taken this firmly in hand, and this is his conviction, as it has been transmitted to him by the path of wisdom, that one should have no doubt about the following: I have come from heaven, I have not always been on earth, I am something created, not something that has always been. I belong to Ormazd, not to Ahriman, to the gods, not to the demons, to the good, not to the bad. I am a human, not a demon, the creature of Ormazd, not of Ahriman. My lineage and family is from Geomard, who was the first human. My mother is Spandarmad, Mother Earth, and my father Ormazd. My humanity is from Machli and Machliani, so the Adam and Eve figures, the first of the lineage and seed of Geomard. My duties and obligations are to think about Ormazd, that he is, has always been, and will always be, that he is the immortal ruler, boundless and pure, while Ahriman is not and shall be destroyed. This text is highly evocative of the existential musings which we find in the rabbinic Jewish tradition. And here, I'm sorry, I dropped a slide out. So as we see in Mishnah Avot 3:1, Akavya ben Mehalel said, Reflect upon these three things, and you will not come within the power of transgression. Know from where you come and where you are going. Where are you from? From a fetid drop. And where are you going? To a place of dust, worms, and maggots. Before whom are you destined to give account and reckoning? Before the Supreme King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be he. As mentioned before, Ormuzd and Ahriman have two radically opposed natures, and therefore there can be no mediation between the two. As I said before, and everything can change except good and bad nature. A good nature cannot change to evil by any means, however, whatever, and a bad nature to goodness in any manner. Ormuzd, on account of a good nature, approves no evil and falsehood, and Ahriman, on account of a bad nature, accepts no goodness and truth. This fundamental opposition is played out daily between the gods and demons, and the Shkan Gumanig Vizar, a 10th century CE polemical text in Pazan, that is Middle Persian and Avestan script, all natural, social, and ethical taxonomies are understood as falling under this rubric of dualism. Even when there are many names and many species of competitors, still then all are within the compass of two names, and these two names are their including source, which are good and evil. The animal world is likewise taxonomized in Zoroastrianism in dualistic terms, between beneficial animals, namely creatures of Ormuzd, and maleficent animals, Pallavi Hrafstar, from Avestan Hrafstra, something like creeping, crawling things, found already in the Gathas. That is, creatures counter-created by the foul spirit, for example, reptiles, rodents, carnivores, parasites, insects, and fantastic animals, such as dragons and griffins. For instance, several species of snakes, reptiles, and serpent-like mythological creatures are enumerated in the Encyclopedic Bundahishan, as well as multiple species of wolves, the paradigmatic hostile mammal for an archaic herding society. The dog lovers among you will no doubt be gratified to see that cats fall in the evil category. It's interesting that in a study of Zoroastrianism in the UK in the 1980s, the ratio of dogs to cats for every 100 domestic animals was something like 95 dogs, 5 cats, which would be unusual in the Western society. One fascinating logical compromise within this dualistic typology of animals was the question of problematic animals that nonetheless provided a real social utility. So we find it stated that Ormuzd mostly diverts, through his omniscience, these noxious creatures for the benefit of his creatures. The bee which prepares honey, the worm from which there is silk. Here we see the two most famous examples being the honeybee and the silkworm, which produce the extremely valuable commodities of honey and silk. Ormuzd did not create them, but he uses his powers positively to retask their evil functions to serve the common good. This is a wonderful example of taxonomic logic, in my view. Among the various hrafstar, or noxious animals, the frog was seen as perhaps the most reviled animal due to its ability to jump to different places and spread pollution and decay. And Ahriman himself is described as being frog-like in appearance. In Zoroastrian doctrine, when humans or animals die, the polluting effects of decay set in immediately upon the corpses of pious humans and good animals, while counterintuitively, the corpses of sinners and evil animals contains much less contamination or none at all, simply because more pollution is required to take down the righteous. In Zoroastrian ritual theory, the degree of pollution caused by the dead body to those in its proximity depends on where the particular creature stands in the hierarchy of living beings. The Avestan ritual text, the Videvdad, the Leviticus of the ancient Iranian world, states that the most contaminating corpse is the dead body of a righteous Zoroastrian priest, who in life was a powerful agent for cleansing the world around him. Conversely, the least contaminating is the corpse of a wicked heretical person, since it takes a minimal amount of pollution to kill him or her. The text then continues on a descending range: warrior, tiller, sheepdog, watchdog, bloodhound, small hunting dog, hedgehog, etc. Manuscher, son of Juanjong, the high priest of the city of Kerman in the 9th century CE, and the greatest Zoroastrian intellectual of the early Islamic centuries, suggests the hard truth that it is unfortunately good people who disproportionately experience evil when he muses that, in general, harm happens to evil people only through the demons, and to good people through the demons and also through evil people. Likewise, the often cited 4th century CE Sasanian theologian, Adurbad, son of Maraspand, is quoted as saying, I am thankful that I am so good a man that the accursed Ahriman brought this misfortune upon me because of my goodness. Just like in the human world, in the Zoroastrian dualistic worldview, the heavens were also taxonomized, with the stars in their fixed and predictable orbits being beneficent, and the planets with their irregular orbits being seen as maleficent. And I quote, "The sphere is the place of the givers, Bagon, who are distributors of goodness, and they distribute in a right way their own portion of goodness. And it is also the place of the seven stars," that is the planets. "The wizards and witches which move beneath them are robbers and antagonistic distributors. They are named bandits according to the religion." The planets, when referred to as demons, were called Abokhtar, retrograde, or Ne'ach-Echtar, non-stars. And as you can see here, they are called Geg, or bandits, in opposition to the beneficent stars, the givers or distributors, Bagon. This latter term, of course, found its way from Old Persian into Proto-Slavic and gives us the Polish word for God. Turning from astronomy to epistemology, we find a corollary in the Shkan Gumonig Vizar, namely, that truth and falsehood ultimately reflect two distinct sources. The possession of truth is the one powerful of the power of the faithful. Through the singleness of truth, the many kinds of falsehood, which must be confused and mutually afflicting to many, are in the aggregate from one source of deceitfulness. Ek boni drozani. Such an idea of the singularity of truth, here etymologically related to the notions of right and straight in Middle Persian, is an archaic concept found already in the closing section of the Yasna ritual in the Young Avestan corpus. Aivo panto yo ashahe, vispe anyaisham apantam. One is the path of truth or order, asha. Those of the others are all non-paths. Any Sanskritist here will immediately recognize Avestan asha as cognate with Vedic urta, equivalently translated as truth or cosmic order, here with a capital O, capital T. As we see in the examples above, Zoroastrian theologies on Ahriman's evil counter-creations and their effects on humans in the natural world were understood in multiple and overlapping registers of metaphysics, ethics, cosmology, and eschatology, all of which contribute to a cohesive, dare I say it, rational worldview that engendered corresponding life practices, which were then fully embedded in Iranian cultural life. Given this metaphysical dichotomy of good and evil and its profound effects on human existence, some of you might be wondering just how much agency do humans actually have in this proxy war of mixed earthly existence. In Middle Persian literature, the choice to fight evil was given to humans prior to their earthly existence when Ormazd offered their pre-souls, Pallavi Fravahar from Avestan Fravashi, a taste of the world to come, and they chose, rightly, to leave the world of thought and enter the material world and fight evil. I quote, "The pre-souls, Fravahar of humans, saw by the wisdom of all knowledge that evil would arrive in the world of the living, and on account of being from the wicked Ahriman, and that the final opposition of the adversary would ultimately disappear at the end, and they agreed to go to the world of the living. By choosing to enter into this mixed material existence, the pre-existing metaphysical constituents of humanity voluntarily chose to experience injury, loss, aging, decay, and death in order to serve as foot soldiers for finally defeating evil in the end times. Despite this doctrine, just as we see in many other religious traditions, the Zoroastrian theologians felt compelled to answer the age-old question regarding the problem of evil in their late antique apologetics. Certain Zoroastrian theologians took great pains to preserve the goodness of Ormazd within this dualistic worldview, and still argued that despite the presence of evil in this world, Ormazd is perfect and omnipotent, simply by knowing his own limits. So for example, we find it stated, "In no matter whatsoever is Ormazd powerless, Atuan Gar, and never was." And yet we also find it stated elsewhere, "Ormazd does not think of a thing which he cannot do, and the foul spirit does think of a thing which he cannot do, and moreover, vows to do it." In the 10th century CE Shkan Gumonig Vizar, we find the central question of the problem of evil being raised quite explicitly. Why does the creator Ormazd not keep Ahriman back from evil doing and evil seeking when he is the mighty maker? The answer is this, that the evil deeds of Ahriman are owing to the evil nature and evil will, which are always his, as the lie. The omnipotence is that which is the omnipotence of the creator Ormazd is that which is over all that is possible to be and is limited thereby. The philosophical compromise inherent in radical dualism in the Zoroastrian text is the admission that God is not omnipotent, though he is omniscient and omnibenevolent. In the passages above, we find it stated in a nuanced way that Ormazd is in fact omnipotent, but just over all that is possible. That is, all that he could think as a perfectly good entity. God would never attempt to make a rock he could not lift, so to speak, nor would his perfect nature let him think bad thoughts. And so God's omnibenevolence is assiduously defended in epideictic discourse. These things are certain. The Creator does not wish anything bad, but there are bad things. What the Creator does not wish, however, he did not create or even attempt to. The Creator is knowledgeable, and someone who is knowledgeable does not strike at someone who is his friend, this is humanity, or even attempt to. Innumerable people are useful to the Creator. Innumerable people are harmful to that which is useful to him and also harm his wish. Unlike his divine counterpart, who can only think and therefore make good as per his good nature, Ahriman conversely counter-creates the demons and pollutes all of Ormazd's pure creations with his fetid and corrupted nature. We find it stated in the Bundahishan that he set his demons upon Ormazd's best creations. He let loose lust, needfulness, danger, pain, disease, vice, and lethargy upon the bull and Gyomat, and I've capitalized them because these are understood to be demons. For the procrastinating individuals among us today, you should feel gratified to know that this isn't a moral failing or a behavioral problem. It's a Zoroastrian demon acting upon you. We also read that the effects of Ahriman's evil actions are felt among the natural elements in the world as well. He, Ahriman, came to the fire. He mingled smoke and darkness within it. Here we see that even fire, the most sacred symbol in Zoroastrianism, acquires mixed properties. I can personally attest to the discomfort of one's eyes watering uncontrollably while sitting in smoky fire temples in Bombay. It's quite a common joke when men go to funerals and they cry, they say, oh no, it's just a fire, it's too much smoke. So, like the demons of evil, desire, let loose on vulnerable humans. Aging and death were considered inevitable byproducts of evil and were understood to be explicitly caused by the demon Zarmon, old age, and Astvihad, the bone untier, the demon of death. For instance, the origins of death and human suffering were understood by the theologians as being logically due to Ahriman's inability to attack Ormazd and his divine retinue directly in the world of thought. Now when the lie and dark seed demons could not reach through their dark substance, the pure spiritual gods, and the place of the luminous supreme heaven, then through the power of falsehood, he, that is Ahriman, commanded victory over the glory of the worldly creatures by two weapons. One, the destruction of the living by the power of death, and one, the captivity of souls by the way of wickedness. Here we find the origins of both extrinsic and intrinsic evil. Death and wickedness in this world are due to the fact that Ahriman, here referred to as the cosmic lie or Druz, along with his demons, are unable to attack Ormazd in the world of thought or Minoi, and so must resort to a proxy war in this material world or Geti, a world purposefully willed into existence from Ormazd's thought in order to entrap metaphysical evil in a physical reality so it can be finally defeated at the end of time. In our physical reality, Ahriman was understood as having four strategies to lure humans to his side: authority, wealth, hypocrisy, and heresy. It is this seductive power of evil that humanity has also to contend with, and thus the Zoroastrian theologians provide us with a psychology of sin by claiming that humans, despite their origins being wholly good, are nonetheless morally malleable and therefore very susceptible to negative peer pressure. The soul fears a crowd as much as the body fears a desert, the reason being that it is mainly in a crowd where the meeting of wicked people occurs. Mob rule, indeed. The Zoroastrian theologians also provide us with a tripartite typology of humans and human nature, including one, humans, madom, demi-humans, literally half-humans, named Merdom, and demi-demons, named Deo. The first type has no doubt about the dualistic origins of the world and believes exclusively in the goodness of Ormazd and rejects heresy. The second type makes purely selfish choices that indiscriminately choose between good and evil. Finally, the third type merely mimics humans in appearance but ultimately believes neither in good nor evil and thinks nothing of personal judgment in the next world. Despite these typologies of human nature, the argument that human nature itself is simply responsible for evil is called into question in a critique of Islam and monotheism more generally in the 10th century CE polemical text, the Shkangomanik Vizar, or Doubt-Dispelling Disquisition. If they say it, that is evil, arose after humankind, as to that when human nature is likewise a product of the sacred being, and the sacred being did not produce evil within the nature of humankind, how has it sprung into action from them? If the evil was set in action by them, humans, apart from the will of God, and a knowledge as to their setting about it existed in God, that implies that God is imperfect in his own will, and humankind is victorious and triumphant in setting aside the will and command of God, and doing evil, competing with the will of God. In this apologetic passage, Mardan Farrokh, son of Ormazdad, our only attested lay Zoroastrian scholar, makes a fundamental critique of Islamic monotheism that suggests that if human nature is responsible for evil, that is, humans make mistakes after they are created by a perfect God, Allah in this case, but human nature itself is a product of God, then there exists a fundamental tension between human agency and divine will. For if God knows they will err, then his will to be omnibenevolent is suspect, and if he does not know that they will stray from his will, that is, humans exercise their moral and ethical agency, then his omniscience must be called into question, and humans can therefore compete with the will of God, calling into question his omnipotence. It is worth stating that the apologetics we see here are the closest thing we have to the more recognizable philosophical discourses of our better attested religious traditions. This is most likely because Mardan Farrokh's literary style is itself a product of the 10th century CE Islamic milieu influenced by Islamic rationalist theology, Ilm al-Kalam, and thus it more closely resembles styles of theological discourse that are most familiar to us as modern readers. We also find a fascinating critique of Christianity by Mardan Farrokh. And I should say this text is really fascinating because you have a lay scholar who has critiques of Manichaeism, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And his knowledge of them is quite developed, strongly suggesting a lot of interaction between the communities. And in his critique of Christianity, he suggests that natural evil, that is evil in the natural world, or evil not caused by human agents, is inconsistent with an omnipotent and omnibenevolent God. If humankind commits sin and crime by their own free will, azad kam, through the will of the sacred being, through what free will and sin are the sin and crime of the lion, serpent, wolf, and scorpion, the stinging and slaying noxious creatures, which are the natural actions that ever proceed from them? Mardan Farrokh here is suggesting that if God, the Christian Lord in this case, is omnibenevolent and allows humans the opportunity to sin and commit evil due to their God-given free will, then perhaps human evil in the world would be explainable. But then why did he make dangerous animals whose basic natures fundamentally harm humans? Why have a serpent of all things in paradise? Put simply, within the tradition-constituted logic of Zoroastrian dualism, any natural calamity not caused by human agents is still evil, a tsunami, for example, and God would once again be ultimately responsible, if not for the dualist view of the world that ascribes all deleterious things, including natural disasters and dangerous flora and fauna, to the foul spirit and his demonic minions and their machinations. Given the discontinuous history and transmission of Zoroastrian knowledge and cultural production, how do the Zoroastrian priests construct and apprehend the sacral power of their religion or deen? How was religious knowledge made accessible to adherents? Who had access to it? Who should teach and who should be taught? In a largely oral priestly tradition, religious knowledge and spiritual wisdom were not primarily found in books, but rather embodied in the person of priests who controlled access and regulated correct praxis through their choice of disciples. Thus, the importance of religious education is repeatedly stressed. Do not consider attending the Herbaristan, it's the priestly school, as bad, for attending the Herbaristan is the life of the people. And we find it stated, do not neglect to attend the Herbaristan, for when one attends the Herbaristan for many years with this one knowledge, that he or she is without doubt that the gods exist and the demons do not. Ormaz, the Lord, does not bring punishment upon him or her. The sixth book of the Denkard, our largest extant Middle Persian text, redacted in Baghdad in the early 11th century CE, provides us with a causality string which extols the ultimate value of proper education in terms of the teleology of human history as it unfolds in Zoroastrian doctrine. From knowledge of the religion, there comes about consideration of the sacred word, Mansaraspand. This is Avestan Mantra Spenta, cognate with Sanskrit mantra. From consideration of the sacred word, there comes about increase of one's calling in religion and worship of the gods. From increase of one's calling in religion and of worship of the gods, the elimination of the demons from the world will occur. From the elimination of the demons of the world, there comes about immortality, the renovation, and the resurrection. This is the term Ristaches, which is first attested in the, has two references in the Avestan corpus prior to the Achaemenid Empire. So, education here is the linchpin to effect positive change, first within the microcosm of oneself and then within the macrocosm of the world, ultimately leading to the final eradication of evil at the end times. Education here, in my opinion, is the principal transmission and explication of the traditional logic of Zoroastrian dualism. I hope my presentation today has achieved the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Vivaina. So we have time for questions.
I was very much intrigued by the text that says that Angramanyu not only will not be, but never was, and does not. Can I think about Angramanyu as a Menongian entity or something
never, like? The key being never was in this world. Always assumed to the debate that they had amongst themselves is was evil purely like was Ahriman purely located up there, and were the demons only up there, and then sort of our bad tendencies are demons, or are they physically here? And it's interesting because the earliest sources, you know, the really archaic texts, the demons are quite tangible. It is the term daiwa, which is the old Indo-Iranian term, which is used for positive for gods, positive deities in the Indo-Iranian tradition, divinity, right? And in the Gathas, they even say, which is a very strange, interesting passage, that it is the daivas, which now are probably the demons, i.e., the old gods. They chose wrong between these two metaphysical entities. That's what the earliest texts say makes them such. The later material then says that they're all created from his evil thought. So Zoroastrianism is not in that sense, you know, a cohesive whole. There are multiple different schools and strands of philosophical thinking, some more, let's say, materialistic and some more on the idealist side. The challenge, of course, is that we have no formal schools, we have no way of historicizing the material, especially since it's sort of a hodgepodge. That is, we're seeing in the same text, you'll see two totally different claims made sometimes in the same manuscript folio. It's driven all the philologists crazy. I mean, just completely nuts.
I have a grammatical question, because in one case, truth is written by capital, in other not. In most cases, it's...
Oh, that's just
No, it is a question.
Yeah.
Because goodness, for example, is not. It is any original hint to translate, or it is an invention of translators?
This is a translation failing on my part, but many of us. So many of these terms of good and bad, there's so many words for good and bad, that what lands up happening is, as philologists, we have this tendency of either capitalizing everything, then everything in the text looks capital, or we put it in italics, in small case, with the original words. And this is just me. I made changes here and there. Personally, I like capitalizing them because for people who cannot read the original, or if you don't have the original, it's worth seeing that every time something is capitalized, you're dealing with a discrete concept which has a whole network of traditional intersignifications connecting to other things. Nothing stands by itself in the system in that sense. So every time you see a word for good, I can guarantee you there will be a word for evil probably 3-4 words later when you get the following parallelism. The challenge, of course, being that you can get two very similar texts and the word for good is slightly different in one and slightly good. So you get a word like weh, which means good. You get a word like nek, which means good. The word here, which says straight, is rast, which is cognate with right. Right is right, left, sinister, wrong. And it's also straight. So the semantics are always conditioned by the original terms in the archaic corpus. But then in the late antique corpus, sometimes they do have a tendency of substituting out the word, probably to show that they know more than simply just using the inherited term. They can substitute new intersignifications.
Some more questions? We still have 10 minutes.
Thank you very much, very interesting. Can you mentioned that there are two quotations in the Western literature to this text, if I understood. So there are two mentions somewhere, or not? I missed it.
So we have the Plutarch.
Oh, Plutarch.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about putting those texts in is that because Zoroastrianism, the Zoroastrian texts, are virtually impossible to historicize. The question that we've always had is, what if this radical dualism became more extreme in reaction to Manichaeism, or more extreme in, let's say, reaction to Islam? That is, it had more monotheistic tendencies, and this is a late antique phenomenon. So the reason to put in the Plutarch is to see that this myth is, while attested in a text that is from the Islamic period, all these Pahlavi texts are actually Islamic, even though they are the late antique corpus, so to speak. The fact that you have it so early is indicative that it existed prior to the, you know, presumably, I mean, it exists in the Parthian period, and the lost Aristotle is even earlier. And so this is one of the great challenges with the Zoroastrian material, because you find things similar to it in other traditions. And of course, there's so many claims about the influence of Zoroastrianism and all the Abrahamic traditions. But historicizing all this stuff is a nightmare. I mean, yeah.
Well, maybe I will continue. So is there, because in the Old Testament, in the Jewish Bible, you can read about Persian.
Sure.
Yeah. So is there, well, I am a layman.
Yeah.
Is there anything in the Bible pointing, because when the Jews were in Assyria, then there is a lot about the Assyrian religion. Is there anything in the Bible about the Persian religion?
Well, there's in fact quite plenty. I mean, the common general idea is that when the Persians liberated the Jews and ended the Babylonian captivity, it's from that period in Jewish history that you start to see concepts for the first time that look quite a lot like the Zoroastrian tradition. And personally, I mean, I'm not one of these. Most of my colleagues are like, they want everything to come from Iran and nothing to come to Iran. You know, it's a little ridiculous. But the important thing to keep in mind is that Zoroastrianism was, in one form or the other, the either the personal religion of the imperial elites of the world's largest empire, and so you have probably quite a bit of spread, though not necessarily proselytizing. And then with the Sasanians and such, you have a massive cosmopolitan empire, Jews, Manichaeans, Christians, all living under Zoroastrian rule. And they were far more aggressive in that time period in terms of responding to and with their, in terms of what we would call their state church. But you know, with Judaism, I mean, it's worth keeping in mind that Jews lived under Zoroastrians for 1,200 years. So the idea that there would be that the influence would be very minimal, I think, is not the way to think about it. Precisely because we should stop thinking of Zoroastrianism simply as a religion. So Jews have their religion in as a minority group, and you've got this majority religion. As I've tried to show you, what we have here with these types of dualistic ideas and trends is Iranian culture. There is no pre-Islamic Iranian culture was what we would now call Zoroastrianism. They get kind of disambiguated with the coming of Islam. So this was just in the air in those places. I mean, that's how I would explain it.
In fact, you just answered my question, but let me make another remark then. I met some experts on Talmud, this is Professor Gabay, really, who work on Zoroastrian material so that they, because they say that quite a lot in the Babylonian Talmud can be understood only as a reaction to some cultural background which is basically Zoroastrian. Otherwise, you are not able to understand many things. So that's exactly what you said.
So this is actually very fascinating in terms of the development of the field. In around 2002-2003, Yaakov Ellman came to Harvard University. I was doing my PhD at the time. And he worked with my former advisor, Prof. Dr. Shervo, and a sort of a new field developed, of which Irano-Talmudica, of trying to historicize textual material in the Bavli that would likely be best understood in its Sasanian context. Now, the problem, of course, with all this material is that the largest Pahlavi text, the Dinkard, is about 170,000 words. You know, with the Bavli, we're looking at 1.3, 1.7, something like that, million. I mean, but the scale is massively different. Same, for example, with the Gathas. 17 hymns for the Iranian world, for the earliest material, compared to the Rig Veda, 1,028. It's just not comparable. So the problem that constantly happens and happened in this new subfield is you find two things that look very similar. Then you get the basic intellectual problem, how do you explain this? Because if you can't quite historicize one, then you land up with a problem where many of the scholars wanted it to be late antique, but many of these Pahlavi texts are actually written down in the Islamic period. And then you have the great question, well, how much commonality can there be? How much back formation? And these are not problems that are ever going to go away. But I have to say that there's been a whole generation of young scholars coming up now working on this stuff. And one recently, less than a month ago, just got hired at UC Irvine to specifically work on Talmud, Middle Persian, Syriac. And I think this is a very healthy thing for the field because there's so much material that connects with not just Talmud, but also with Christian sources, Syriac, and now with we finding a lot of new things, we're seeing these Neoplatonic material that look that have very similar Zoroastrian analogs. And since Khosrow I actually invited these Neoplatonists into the Persian Empire at precisely the time when this material seems to look like, there's a lot of possibilities. It's just the philological difficulties with this material are very, very acute.
Is it working?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a short question. Shoot. In the title of your talk, you put the word logic between quotation marks. Am I to understand that you find it's not really a logic at all, or does it violate our logic? Because from your talk, I get the impression that it's a very straightforward two-value logic applied to the whole world.
Yeah. The reason to do it that way is that we don't have formal philosophical discourse like we have in other traditions. So I just simply mean, it's sort of the, Professor Bronckhorst said something similar the other day when he said that, you know, some of these things have to be understood implicitly. Now, I mean, I think this is actually, by all religious standards, quite a rational system. In fact, in my opinion, my presentation has over-rationalized it because we do have monistic strands. We do have things like the notion of the mean from the Neoplatonists, which seems to factor in and then has an uneasy relationship with radical dualism. So I don't want to underplay those things. But the great challenge of this tradition is that among all the major, and this is a major tradition, it's just not, there's not a lot of people today in the ancient and late antique world. The number of specialists is so minuscule. There are virtually no one, there are four or five people in North America and people scattered over the rest of the place. And since the materials have been extremely difficult philologically, we've never had a serious philosopher who has philological ability. So when the texts are read, they just miss the stuff. And same, it's only in the last 20 years, 30 years, have we had serious legal theory people working. And all of a sudden, when the Talmudists arrived, they saw legal arguments that we just saw as glossing. So this is an important, this is a major and important point that I think sometimes is lost in these multidisciplinary audiences, that every field-specific disciplinary sociology of knowledge conditions how the kind of questions we ask, but the kind of questions we ask are conditioned by the type of people we have in the field. Another point, just to contrast with, say, Jewish studies, there are virtually no living practitioners or people from the community who actually work on Zoroastrianism. I actually happen to be from the Zoroastrian community. I'm an exception. I mean, compared to, let's say, Jewish studies, where virtually everyone is from the tradition. So you have a kind of philological fundamentalism on one side in the Iranian world, and you have a lot of faith commitments in the Jewish studies, which, you know, I mean, they all, as with all these fields, that they're not the same, if you see my point, in terms of the human personnel. I think that makes a very big difference.
Okay, I'm afraid we don't have more time for questions. Let's thank once more Professor Rivera.